Many people acknowledge that natural selection is the artificer of the body, but draw the line when it comes to the human mind. The mind is biological evolution. To be, or as a clumsy programmer's hack, or was given its shape by cultural rather than biological evolution. Tubi and Cosmides point out a delicious irony. The eye, biological evolution. Example of fine engineering by natural selection is not just any old organ that can be sequestered with flesh and sample of fine engineering by natural stone. Far away doesn't digest food or, except in the case of Superman, change anything in the physical world. What does the eye do? The eye is an organ of information processing, firmly connected to, anatomically speaking, a part of, the brain. And all those delicate optics and intricate circuits in the retina do not dump information into a yawning, empty orifice. Receiver of this richly structured message must be every bit as well engineered as the sender. Seen in comparing human vision and robot vision, the parts of the mind that allow us to see are indeed well engineered, and there is no reason to think that the quality of engineering progressively deteriorates as the information flows upstream to the on what we see. The adaptionist program in biology, or the careful use of natural selection to reverse engineer the parts of an organism, is sometimes ridiculed as an empty exercise in after-the-fact storytelling. In the satire of the syndicated columnist Cecil Adams, "The reason our hair is brown is that it enabled our monkey ancestors to hide amongst the coconuts." Admittedly, there is no shortage of bad evolutionary explanations. Why do men avoid asking for directions? Because our male ancestors might have been killed if they approached a stranger. What purpose does music serve? It brings the community together. Why did happiness evolve? Because happy people are pleasant to be around, so they attracted more allies. What is the function of humor? To relieve tension. Why do people overestimate their allies, operate effectively in life? These musings strike us as glib and lame, but it is not because they dare to seek an evolutionary explanation of how some part of the mind works. It is because they botch the job. First, many of them never bother to establish the facts. Has anyone ever documented that women like to ask for direction? Second, even if the facts had been established, the stories try to explain one puzzling fact by trying to explain some other fact that is just as much of a puzzle, getting us nowhere. Why do rhythmic noises bring a community together? People like to be with happy people. Why does humor relieve tension? Why obvious to each of us here inside our heads that they don't need to be explained. But all to be explained up for grabs. Every reaction, every pleasure, every taste, when we try to explain how it evolved. We could have evolved like the Samaritan 1 robot, which sacrificed itself to save a sack of lima beans, or like dung beetles, which must find dung delicious, or like the masochist in the old joke about sadomasochism. Masochist. Hit me. Sadist. No. A good adaptationist explanation needs the fulcrum of an engineering analysis that is independent of the part of the mind we are trying to explain. The analysis begins with a goal to be attained and a world of causes and effects in which to attain it, and goes on to specify what kinds of designs are Fortunately for those who think that the departments in a university reflect meaningful divisions of knowledge, it means that psychologists have to look outside psychology if they want to explain what the parts of the mind are for. To understand sight, we have to look to and computer vision systems. To understand movement, we have to look to robotics. To understand optics and computer vision systems, optics and familial feelings. To understand cooperation and conflict, we have to look to the mathematics of games and to economic modeling. Once we have a spec sheet for a well-designed mind, we can see whether Homo sapiens has that kind of mind. We do the experiment kind of mind to get the facts down about a mental faculty, and then see whether the faculty meets the specs. Specialization in solving its assigned problem, especially in comparison with the vast number, minds that are biologically growable. The logic of reverse engineering has guided researchers in visioning has got for over a century, and that may be why we understand vision better than we understand any other part of the perception for over a century. There is no reason, and that may be why we should not bring insight about the rest of the mind. An interesting example is a new theory of pregnancy sickness, traditionally called morning sickness, by the biologist Margie Proffitt. Many pregnant women become nauseated and avoid certain foods. Though their sickness is usually explained away as a side effect of hormones, there is no reason that hormones should induce nausea and food aversions rather than, say, hyperactivity, aggressiveness, or lust. The Freudian explanation is equal rather than a woman's loathing of her husband and her unconscious desire to abort the fetus orally. Proffitt predicted that pregnancy sickness should confer some benefit that offsets the cost of lowered. Proffitt predicted that activity. Pregnancy sickness sins. The poisonous food is ejected from the stomach before it can do much harm, and our appetite for similar foods is reduced in the future. Perhaps pregnancy sickness protects women against eating or digesting foods with toxins that digest harm the developing fetus. Your local Happy Carrot health food store notwithstanding, there is that might harm the developing fetus, that might harm the developing healthy about natural. Your creature has no more desire to be eaten than you do, and since it can't very well defend itself through, and since it can't very well do chemical warfare. Most plants have evolved dozens of toxins in their tissues. Insecticides in their tissue, repellents, irritants, paralytics, poisons, and other sand to throw in herbivores, insect repellents, irritants, insect repellents, herbivores, paralytics to detoxify the poisons, and the taste sensation we call bitterness to deter we call bitterness to ingest them. But the usual defenses may not be enough to protect a tiny embryo. So far, this may not sound much better than the barf up your baby theory. But Proffitt synthesized hundreds of studies, done independently of each other and of her hypothesis, that support it. She meticulously documented that, 1, plant toxins in dosages that adults tolerate can cause birth defects and induce abortion when ingested by pregnant women. 2, pregnancy sickness begins at the point when the embryo's organ systems are being laid down, and the embryo is most vulnerable to teratogens. Embryo's organ system growing slowly and has only a modest need for nutrients. 3, pregnancy sickness wanes at the stage when the embryo's organ systems are nearly complete and its biggest need is for nutrients to allow it to grow. 4, with pregnancy sickness, selectively avoid bitter, pungent, highly flavored, and novel foods. Women's sense of smell becomes hypersensitive during the window of pregnancy sickness and less sensitive than pregnant thereafter. 6, foraging peoples, including presumably our ancestors, are at even higher risk of ingesting plant toxins because they eat wild plants rather than domesticated crops bred for palatability. 8, women with more severe pregnancy sickness are less likely to miscarry. Women with more severe pregnancy sickness are less likely to bear babies with birth defects. Baby-making system in a natural ecosystem ought to work, and how the feelings of modern the fit between how a baby-making system the fit between how a baby system in a natural is correct. Reverse engineering is possible only when reverse engineering the device was designed to accomplish. We do not understand the olive pitter until we catch on that it was designed as a machine for pitting olives, rather than as a paperweight or wrist exerciser. The goals of the designer must be sought for every part of a complex device and for the device as a whole. Automobiles have a component, the carburetor, that is designed to mix air and gasoline, and mixing air and gasoline is a sub-goal of the ultimate goal, carting people around. Mobile are highly organized to bring about certain goals and reverse engineers that, like the auto in its design. Was the human mind ultimately designed to create beauty, to discover truth, to love and to work, to harmonize with other human beings and with nature? The logic of natural selection gives the answer. The ultimate goal that the mind was designed to attain is maximum of natural selection gives the answer. The ultimate only about the long-term fate of entities that replicate. that is, entities that repeat a stable identity across many generations of copying. It predicts only that replicators whose effects tend to enhance the probability whose effects tend to replication come to predominate. When we ask questions like who or what of their own replication, company of their own replication, tend to predominate. 9-4. The theory of natural selection provides the answer. The long provides the answer. The long means. Even our bodies, ourselves, are not the ultimate beneficiary of our design. As Gould has said, what is the individual reproductive success of which Darwin speaks? It cannot be the passage of one's body into the next generation, for truly you can't take it with you in this sense above all. The criterion by which genes get selected is the quality of the bodies they build, but it is the genes that make it into the next generation, not the perishable bodies, that are selected to live and fight another day. Though there are some holdouts, such as Gould himself, the genes I view success. It has asked and is finding answers to the deepest questions about us too, such as how life arose, why there are cells, why there are bodies, why there is sex, how the genome is structured, animals interact socially, and why there is communication. It is as indispensable to researchers in animal why animals interact socially and behavior as Newton's laws are why there is communication. Almost everyone misunderstands the theory. Contrary to popular belief, the gene-centered theory of evolution does not imply that the point of all human striving is to spread our genes. With the exception of the fertility doctor who artificially the donors to the sperm bank for Nobel Prize winners and other actually inseminated patients with his own spooks, no human being, Dawkins explained the theory in a book called The Selfish Gene, and the metaphor was chosen carefully. People don't selfishly spread their genes. Genes selfishly spread themselves. They do it by the way they build our brains. By making us enjoy life, health, sex, friends, and children, the genes build our brains. By making us buy a lottery ticket for representation, enjoy life, environment in which we evolved. Our goals are sub-goals of the ultimate goal of the genes, supplicating themselves. But the two are different. As far as we are concerned, our goals, conscious or unconscious, are not about genes at all, but about health and lovers and children and friends. The confusion between our goals and our genes' goals has spawned one muddle after another. The reviewer of a book about the evolution of sexuality protests that human adultery, unlike the animal equivalent, cannot be a strategy to spread the genes because adulterers take steps to prevent pregnancy. But cannot be a strategy to spread the cannot be a strategy to spread the genes because adult genes. It is people's strategy to attain sexual desire is not people's strategy. Sexual desire is not people's strategy to propagate their genes. If the genes don't get propagated, it's because we are smarter than they are. Because we are smarter than they are. Gould complains that if altruism, according to biologists, is just helping kin or exchanging favors, both of which serve the interests of one's genes, it would not really be altruism after all, but some kind of hypocrisy. The interests of one's genes, if the interests of one's genes, would not really be buildings. Selfish genes don't necessarily specify selfish organisms. Sometimes the most selfish thing a gene can do is to build a selfless brain. Genes are a play within a play. Genes, interior monologue of the players. Intelligence is that human flesh is suffused with a non-material entity, the soul, material entity envisioned as some kind of ghost or spirit. But the theory faces an insurmountable problem. How does an ethereal nothing respond to flashes, pokes, and beeps, and get arms and legs to move? Another problem is the overwhelming evidence that the mind is the activity of the brain. The supposedly immaterial soul, we know now, can be bisected with a knife, altered by chemicals, started or stopped by electricity, and extinguished by a sharp blow or by insufficient oxygen. Under a microscope, the brain has a breathtaking complexity of physical structure fully commensurate. Another explanation is that mind comes from some extraordinary form of matter. ordinary form of matter. It was animated by a magical kind of wood found by Geppetto that talked, laughed, and moved on its own. Discovered such a wonder substance. At first one might think that the wonder substance is brain past. No one has ever discovered such a wonder. Darwin wrote substance. Philosopher John Searle has argued that the physico-chemical properties of brain tissue just as breast tissue produces milk and plant tissue produces sugar. But recall that the same kinds of membranes and chemicals are found in brain tissue throughout the animal kingdom, not to mention in brain tumors. But not all of them accomplish human-like intelligence. Of course, brain is necessary for our intelligence, but the physical properties are not sufficient, brain architecture and the physical properties of oxide particles are not sufficient. Properties of bricks are not sufficient to explain music. Intelligence has often been attributed to some kind of energy flow attributed field. Orbs, luminous vapors, auras, vibrations, magnetic fields and lines of force figure prominently in spiritualism, pseudoscience, and science fiction kitsch. The school of Gestalt psychology tried to explain visual illusions in terms of electromagnetic force fields on the surface of the brain, but the fields were never found. Occasionally, the brain surface has been described as a continuous vibrating medium that supports holograms or other wave interference. Model with its psychic pressure building up, bursting. Idea too has not panned out. The hydraulic and can be found in dozens of everyday metaphors. Anger welling up, letting off. Exploding under the pressure, blowing one's stack, venting one's feelings, bottling up rage. But even the hottest emotions do not literally correspond to a buildup and discharge of energy in the... as a negotiating tactic, like a terrorist with explosives strapped to his body. A problem is that even if we did discover some gel or vortex or vibration or orb, with all these ideas is that even if we with all these ideas is that even if Geppetto did discover some just on rational rules and pursued a goal in the face of obstacles, we would still be faced with obstacles. It accomplished those feats. No, intelligence does not come from a special kind of spirit or matter or energy, but from a different commodity, information. Information is a correlation between two things that is produced by a lawful process, as opposed to coming about by sheer chance. We say that the rings in a stump carry information about the age of the tree because their number correlates with the tree's age. The older the tree, the more rings it has. And the correlation is not a coincidence, but is caused by the way trees grow. Correlation is a mathematical and logical concept. It is not caused by the way trees grow. Correlation in itself is nothing special. It is found wherever causes leave effects. What is special is information processing. We can regard a piece of matter that carries information about some state of affairs as a symbol. It can, as for that state of affairs. But as a piece of matter, it can do other things as well. Physical things. Stand for that state of affairs. Stand for that kind of matter in that kind. Tree rings carry information about age, but they also reflect light and absorb age material. Footprints carry information about animal motions, but they also trap water and cause eddies in the wind. Now here is an idea. Suppose one were to build a machine with parts that are affected. Now here is an idea by the physical properties of some symbol. Or magnet is set in motion by the pigment absorbed by a tree ring, or the water trapped in a tree ring, or the white reflected by a chalk mark, or the magnetic charge in a bit of oxide. And suppose that the machine then caught to happen in some other pile of matter. It burns new marks onto a piece of wood, or stamps impressions. This happened so far. All I have described is a chain of physical events accomplished by a pointless contraption. Here is the special step. Imagine that we now try to interpret the newly arranged piece of matter using the scheme according to which the original piece carried information. Say we count the newly burned wood rings and interpret them as the age of some tree at some time, even though they were not caused by the growth of any tree. And let's say that the machine was some time since, that is, so that they carried information about something in the world. A machine that scans the rings in a stump, burns one mark on a nearby plank for each ring. When we count the marks on the plank, we have the age of the first tree at the time that the second one was planted. We would have a kind of rational machine, a machine that produces true conclusions from true premises, not because of any special gene. All we have is a carefully contrived chain of ordinary physical events, whose first ordinary physical event of matter that carries information. Our rational machine owes its rationality to two properties glued together in the entity we call a symbol. A symbol carries information, and it causes things to happen. Tree rings correlate with the age of... A symbol carries... When the caused things themselves carry information, we call the whole system an information processor, or a computer. Now, this whole scheme might seem like an unrealizable hope. What guarantee is there that any collection of thingamabobs can be arranged to fall or swing or shine in just the right pattern so that when their effects are interpreted, the interpretation will make sense? More precisely, so that it will make sense according to some prior law or relationship we find interesting. Any heap of stuff can be given a contrived interpretation after the fact. How confident can we be that some machine will make marks that actually correspond to some meaningful state of the world, like the age of a tree when another tree as opposed to being a meaningless pattern corresponding to nothing at all? The guarantee comes from the work of the mathematician Alan Turing. He designed a hypothetical machine whose input symbols and output symbols could correspond, depending on the details of the machine, to any one of a vast symbols and output symbols could correspond symbols and output interpretations. Bond pairs, a read-write head that can print or read a symbol on a square and move the tape in a symbol direction, a pointer that can point to a fixed number of tick marks on the machine, and a set of mechanical reflexes. Each reflex is triggered by the symbol being read and the current position of the pointer, and it prints a symbol on the tape. Each reflex is triggered by the symbol being moves the tape and or shifts the pointer read and the current position. This design is called a Turing machine. What can this simple machine do? It can take in symbols standing for a number or a set of numbers and print out symbols standing for new numbers that are the corresponding value for any mathematical function that can be solved by a step-by-step sequence of operations I'm being imprecise to convey the importance of Turing's discovery without the technicalities. It can apply the rules of any useful logical system to derive true statements from other true statements. It can apply the rules of any grammar to derive well-formed sentences. The equivalence among Turing machines, calculable mathematical functions, logics, and grammars led the logician Alonzo Church to conjecture that any well-defined recipe or set of steps that is guaranteed can be implemented on a Turing machine. What does this mean? It means that to the extent that the world obeys mathematics, what does the machines that can be solved step mean? World, and makes predictions about it. To the extent that rational thought corresponds to the rules of logic, a machine can be built that carries out rational thought. To the extent that a language can be captured by a set of grammatical rules, a machine can be built that produces grammatical sentences. Turing showed that rational machines, machines that use the physical properties of symbols to crank out new symbols that make some kind of sense, are buildable, indeed easily buildable. The computer scientist Joseph Weizenbaum once showed how to build one out of a indeed easily buildable pie, some rocks, and a roll of. The computer didn't even need a huge warehouse of these machines, one to do sums, another to do square roots, a third to print English sentences, and so on. One kind of Turing machine is called a universal Turing machine. It can take in a description of any other Turing machine printed on its tape, and thereafter mimic that machine exactly. A single machine can be programmed to do anything that any set of rules can do. Does this mean that the human brain is a Turing machine? Certainly not. There are no Turing machines in use anywhere, let alone in our heads. They are useless in practice. They are useless in practice. Are no Turing too slow. But it does not matter. Too clumsy, too hard to program. Turing merely wanted to prove that too big symbol processor. Not long after his discovery, more practical symbol processors were designed, some of which became IBM and UNIVAC mainframes, and later Macintoshes and PCs. But all of them were equivalent to Turing's universal machine. If we ignore size and speed and give... But all of them were equivalent to Turing as much memory storage as they need, as universal machine wants to the same inputs. Still other kinds of symbol processors have been proposed as models of the human mind. These models are often simulated on commercial computers, but that is just a convenience. The commercial computer is first programmed to emulate the hypothetical mental computer, creating what... Scientists call a virtual machine programmed to emulate a PC. Only the virtual mental computer is taken seriously, not the silicon chips that emulate it. Then a program that is meant to model some sort of thinking, solving a problem, understanding a sentence, is run on the virtual mental computer. A new way of understanding human understanding a sentence is run on the intelligence has been born. Virtual mental computer is only as good as the facts it explains and the discoveries it inspires. The biggest selling point for the computational theory of mind is its impact on psychology. Skinner and other behaviorists insisted that all talk about mental events was sterile speculation. Only stimulus-response connections could be studied in the lab and in the field. Exactly the opposite turned out to be true. Before computational ideas were imported in the 1950s and 1960s by Newell and 1960s by Newell, Donald Broadbent, psychology was dull, dull, dull. The psychology curriculum comprised physiological psychology, which meant reflexes, and perception. The psychology curriculum comprised, which meant beeps, and learning, physiological psychology, and intelligence, which meant IQ, and personality, which meant personality tests. Since then, psychology has brought the questions of history's deepest thinkers into the laboratory and has made thousands of discoveries on every aspect of the mind that could not have been dreamed of a few decades ago. The blossom of every aspect of the mind that could not came from a central agenda for psychology been dreamed of bring the form of mental representations, the symbol inscriptions used by the mind, and the processes, the demons, that access them. Plato said that we are trapped inside a cave and know the world only through the shadows it casts on the wall. The skull is our cave, and mental represents the world only through the shadows it casts. The world are the shadows on the wall. That we can know about the world. Consider, as an analogy, how external representations work. My bank statement lists each deposit as a single sum. If I deposited several checks and some cash, I cannot verify whether a particular check was among them. That information was obliterated in the representation. What's more, the form of a representation determines what can easily be inferred from it, because the symbols and their arrangement are the only things a homunculus stupid enough to be replaced by a machine can respond to. Our representation of numbers is valuable because addition can be valuable because addition can be can respond to. Looking up entries in the addition table and carrying digits formed on the numbers with a few drone lights. Roman numerals and operations. Addition operations are far more complicated with them, and multiplication and division operations are probably impossible. Pinning down mental representations is the route to rigor in psychology. Many explanations of behavior have an airy-fairy feel to them because they explain psychological phenomena. Do people have more trouble with this task than with that one? Because the first one is more difficult. Why do people generalize a fact about one object to another object? Because the objects are similar. Why do people notice this event but not that one? Because the first event is more salient. Why do people notice this event? These explanations are not that one. Salience are in the mind of the beholder, which is what we should be trying to explain. A computer finds it more difficult to remember the gist of Little Red Riding Hood than to remember a 20-digit number. You find it more difficult to remember the number than the gist. You find two crumpled balls of newspaper to be similar, to remember the number than the gist. Their shapes are completely different. Their shapes are almost the same. Migrating birds that navigate at night by the stars in the sky find the positions of the constellations at different times of night quite salient. To a typical person, they are barely noticeable. But if we hop down to the level of representations, we find a firmer sort of entity, which can be rigorously counted and matched. If a theory of psychology is any good, it should predict that the representations required by the difficult task can be difficult task, can if psychology is any trigger a longer chain of demons than those of the easy task. It should predict that the representations of two similar things have more shared symbols and fewer non-shared symbols. The representations of dissimilar things have more different representations from their neighbors. The non-salient entities should have the same ones. Research in cognitive psychology has tried to triangulate on the mind's internal representations by measuring people's reports, reaction times, and errors as they remember, solve problems. Recognize objects and reaction times realize is perhaps the most telltale sign that the mind uses mental representations, and lots of them. Suppose it takes a while for you to learn to read a fancy new typeface festooned with curlicues. You have practiced with some words and are now as quick as you are for any other typeface. Now you see a familiar word that was not in words and are now as... Do you have to relearn that the word is a noun? Do you have to relearn how to pronounce it? Relearn that the referent is an animal? What the referent looks like? That it has mass and breathes and suckles its young? Surely not. But this banal talent of yours tells a story. Your knowledge about the word elk could not have been connected directly to the physical shapes of printed letters. If it had, then when new letters were introduced, your knowledge would have no connection to them and would be unavailable until you learned the connections anew. In reality, your knowledge must have been connected to a node, a number, an address in memory, presenting the abstract word elk. And a, or an entry in a mental entry must be neutral with respect to dictionary learned the new typeface, you created a new visual trigger for the letters of the alphabet, which in turn triggered the old elk entry, and everything hooked up to the entry was instantly available, without your having to reconnect, piece by piece, everything you know about elks to the new way of printing elk. This is how we know, piece by piece, everything you know about that your mind contains mental elks to the new words, not just the shapes of the words when they are printed. These leaps, and the inventory of internal representations they hint at, are the hallmark of human cognition. If you learned that wapiti was another name for an elk, you could take all the facts connected to the word elk and instantly transfer them to wapiti was another name for an elk, you could wapiti, without having to solder new all the facts. Of course, only your zoological knowledge would transfer. You would not expect wapiti to be pronounced like elk. That suggests you have a level of representation specific to the concepts behind the words, not just the words themselves. Your knowledge of facts about elks hangs off the concept, the words themselves. The elk and wapiti also hang off the... Your knowledge of facts and pronunciation hang off the word elk. We have moved upward from the typeface. Now let's move downward. If you had learned the typeface as black ink on white paper, you wouldn't have to relearn it for white ink on red paper. This unmasks a representation for visual edges. Any color abutting any other color is seen as an edge. Edges define strokes. An arrangement of strokes makes up an alphanumeric character. Character. Find strokes everywhere we look in the mind. Say I asked you to print the word elk in any typeface you wanted, but with your left hand, if you are a righty, or by writing it in the sand with your toe wanted, but with your left hand, or by tracing it with a penlight, if you are a but recognizable. You might have to practice to get the motions to be smoother, but you would not have to relearn the strokes composing each letter, let alone the alphabet or the spelling of every English word. This transfer of skill must tap into a level of representation for motor control that specifies a geometric transfer of skill must tap into a trick trajectory, not the level of represent. The trajectory would be translated into actual motions by lower level control programs for each appendage. The combinatorics of mentalese and of other representations composed of parts explain the inexhaustible repertoire of human thought and action. A few elements and a few rules that can explain the inexhaustible repertoire behind them can generate an unfathomably of human thought and action because the number of possible representations grows exponentially with their size. Language is an obvious example. Say you have 10 choices for the word to begin a sentence, 10 choices for the second word, yielding 100 two-word beginnings, 10 choices for the third word, yielding 1,000 three-word beginnings, and so on. 10 is, in fact, the approximate geometric mean of the number of word choices available at each point in assembling a grammatical and sensible sentence. A little arithmetic shows that the number of sentences of 20 words or less, not an unusual length, is about 10 to the 20th, is about 10 to the 20th number of sentences, or 100 million trillion, or 100 power, a 1 followed by times the number of seconds since the 20 zeros. Bring up the example to impress you not with the vastness of language, but with the vastness of thought. Language, after all, is not scat singing. Every sentence expresses a distinct idea. There are no truly synonymous sentences. So, in addition to whatever ineffable thoughts people might have, they can entertain something like 100 million. So, in addition to whatever indifferent ineffable thoughts, real immensity of thinkable structures is found in many spheres of human activity. John Stuart Mill was alarmed to discover that the finite number of musical notes, together with the maximum practical length of a musical piece, meant that the world would soon run out of melodies. At the same time he sank into this melancholy, Brahms meant that the world would soon run out of Mahler, Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff, and Stravinsky's. Genres of ragtime, jazz, Broadway musicals, electric blues, country and electric blues, samba, reggae, and punk. We are unlikely to have a melody shortage anytime soon, because shortage anytime soon. If each note of a melody can be selected from, say, 8 notes on average, music is combinatorial. Music is combinatorial. 64 pairs. If each note of a notes, 4,096 phrases of 4 notes, and so on, multiplying out to trillions and trillions of musical pieces. What about consciousness? What makes us actually suffer the pain of a toothache or see the blue of the sky as blue? The computational theory of mind, even with complete neural underpinnings, offers no clear answer. The symbol blue is inscribed, goal states change underpinnings offers. Consciousness has struck many thinkers as not just a problem, but almost a miracle. Consciousness presents us with puzzle after puzzle. How can a neural event cause consciousness? Consciousness presents. What good is consciousness with puzzle after puzzle add to the train of billiard ball events taking place in our neural computers? Something is red, noticing it against a sea of green, saying out loud, "That's red," reminiscing about Santa Claus, air engines, becoming agitated, could be accomplished by pure information processing triggered by a sense of fire engines becoming light. Could be occurring over the symbols, like the lights flashing on a computer, or the thunder that accompanies lightning, or the thunder. If consciousness is useless, if a creature could without it negotiate the world as well as a creature with it, why would natural select conscious one? Consciousness has recently become the circle that everyone wants to have favored the conscious one. Square. Almost every month an often with a raspberry blown at the theologians and humanists who would put boundaries on scientists who would put boundaries on the scientists and philosophers who dismiss the topic as too subjective or muddled to be studyable. People who write about consciousness are not crazy, so they must have something different in mind when they use the word. One of the best observations about the concept of consciousness came from Woody Allen in his hypothetical college course catalog. Introduction to Psychology. The theory of human behavior. Is there a split between mind and body? And if so, which is better to have? Theory of human behavior as opposed to unconsciousness, with many helpful... Special consideration is given to hints on how to remain conscious. The study of consciousness sets readers up with one meaning of an ambiguous word and surprises them with another. Theoreticians also trade on the ambiguity of the word consciousness, not as a joke, but as a bait and switch. The reader is led to expect a theory sense of the word, the hardest to explain, and is given a theory for another sense, the easiest to explain. To dwell on definition to explain, and end by disentangling the meanings. Sometimes synonym for intelligence. Gould, for example, must have been using it in this way. But there are three more specialized meanings. By the linguist Ray Jackendoff and the philosopher Ned Block. One is self-knowledge, Not only can I feel pain and see red, I can think to myself, hey, here I am, Steve Pinker, to myself and seeing red. Oddly enough, this recondite sense of the word is the one that most academic discussions have in mind. Conscious discussion is typically defined as building an internal model of the world that contains the self. Reflecting back on oneness is typically defined as building an oneness is typically defending an internal model of the world is commonly understood, being alive and awake and aware. Self-knowledge, including the ability to use a mirror, is no more mysterious than any other topic in perception and memory. If I have a mental database for people, what's to prevent it from containing an entry for myself? If I can learn to raise my arm and crane my neck to sight a hidden spot on my back, why couldn't I learn to raise a mirror and look up at it to sight a hidden spot on my forehead? And access to information about the self is perfectly easy. And even modifies itself. A robot that could recognize itself in a mirror would not be much more difficult to build than a robot that could recognize anything at all. There are, to be sure, good questions to ask about the difficult to build than a robot that could recognize difficult to build than a robot its development in anything at all. But self-knowledge is an everyday topic in cognitive science, not the paradox of water of science. Because it is so easy to say something about self-knowledge, writers can crow about their theory of consciousness. End of side 2. Please turn to side 3.